Your Mac Show. Thanks for tuning in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. This is a show dedicated to the promotion of individual rights as exemplified in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. My listeners know that I had Larry Beecraft on last week, and he agreed graciously to come back on this week, and we covered a lot of ground on, first of all, federal jurisdiction, and then we barely got into some related issues, one of which is the federal income tax last week. So we want to recap what we talked about last week for those of you that might have missed it, summarize those comments, and then move forward into the little more detailed discussion of the federal income tax. So, Larry, thank you again for taking time on your Sunday afternoon to come on the Peter Mac Show.
Well, Peter, it's my pleasure to be your guest.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you. And you have your own show, we should remind people, at 9 a.m., 9 to 10 Central Time on Saturdays, correct?
That's right. We had a show yesterday, had Phil Marsh on, Phil Hart. And then Ed and Elaine Brown called in, and they told us what they were going through. And I think everybody needs to be interested in their situation and complain to public officials about it.
Well, right. I don't have anything. If you have something later than more recent than I have, please correct me or catch me up there. Go ahead.
I was sitting here doing work at the office on Thursday afternoon when I got an email that said, the feds have struck at the Browns. And then I listened to a radio broadcast over the internet. It's a competing network, but it's Alex Jones. I went over to Prison Planet and listened to some of the discussion. I've listened to a good bit of their broadcast from their home. What happened on Thursday morning is that a friend of theirs that was staying with them at the house went to walk the dog.
Right.
And he got up to the head of the driveway where it meets Center of Town Road there in Plainsville. You know, the driveway hits that particular road. They're on that road. That's their address. And there were some marshals out there. They were in camouflage fatigues. They had guns. And when this guy saw these agents, he thought that they were just men out hunting. Then when he saw that they were marshals, he turned and fled, and they shot at him twice.
Right.
And then he went back down to the – then he was trying to run on down the road, and he got tackled, and then he was put into one of these black blazers and hauled off to a park, and they interrogated him for a while, and then they released him. They told him not to talk to anyone about it, but he's come out and talked about his captivity there for a while. But it appears to me that what's happening with the Browns is you've got an effort to test – the defenses for the Browns' home. So the feds came out on Thursday morning, stayed there for a while, telegraphed to the occupants of the Browns' home that, hey, watch out, we're coming back. Right. I expect that they will, and this whole situation might turn into another bad instance that grabs headline news. I hope it doesn't do that.
Well, right. We hope for the best, obviously, for Ed and Elaine Brown. And we won't go into all the details here of their case, but basically they went to court, didn't feel like they were getting a fair trial, and walked out of court, as I recall, Larry, and have been holed up in their homes, or at least Ed has, for 4 or 5 months now. I had him on my show when this saga began back in January, so it's ongoing as far as we know now.
You hit the nail on the head. That's a very appropriate description.
Okay. Well, Larry, if you could recap for us, we were discussing federal jurisdiction and the limits thereof last time. And
let me just kind of take off, and I want to apologize for our listeners last week. I was somebody that I didn't get a whole lot of sleep, and I came in and did your show, Peter, when I was full of coffee. So I was just kind of running off at the mouth.
No, you were fine. You happen to know a lot of information, Larry, that the rest of us who are not versed in the law don't know, and that's understandable. Folks, there's our first break.
Let's talk about jurisdiction when we come back, Peter.
We will. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back here in just a couple minutes.
PersonalArms.com has all your self-defense needs. PersonalArms.com carries the highest quality law enforcement grade pepper spray and sells it at true wholesale prices that start at $6.95. Check out our new electronic barking dog alarm. This electronic watchdog sees through walls. Electronic barking dog alarm works when an intruder comes within 15 feet. The barking dog alarm will begin barking like a true-to-life angry German Shepherd. The closer the intruder comes, the more frequent and more threatening the barking becomes. You can purchase stun guns, stun batons, pepper spray, telephone voice changers, martial arts instructional DVDs, and the same tasers that you have seen the police use on TV and more at www.personalarms.com/RBN. That's www.personalarms.com/RBN or call 1-201-641-1442. Don't be afraid anymore. Receive a free pepper spray by mentioning RBN when you place your online order. We will not sell items prohibited by any state, county, or local law, so check your laws before making a purchase.
Since 1988, Herbal Healer Academy has been the global supplier of the finest natural medicines. We specialize in keeping you alive and healthy. We provide outstanding products like ECX, colloidal silver, olive leaf extract, oregano oil, and hundreds of herbals, oils, books, and educational materials. We have homeopathic detox solutions for chemtrails, radiation, MSG, and aspartame poisoning. We also train naturopathic healers via correspondence education. Why wait any longer? Go ahead and do it today. Sign up on the web and receive our new 120-page catalog and a current Herbal Healer newsletter free. Simply log on to herbalhealer.com and check out the online member testimonials and our hundreds of exceptional products. That's herbalhealer.com, your website for safe, effective, natural alternatives and education. That's herbalhealer.com.
Hi, Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. Sure, you've got a mortgage and credit cards. Your debt creation is probably the smartest thing you've ever done. How would it be to find $75,000, $150,000, $200,000 or more you never knew you had? Now the task force has strategies to make these debts into virtual savings accounts. Ben Franklin said, a penny saved is a penny earned. By doing nothing more than you're doing right now, because you've used your credit, the right strategies can make the debt part of your financial life the smartest thing you've ever done. Oh, by the way, your strategies cost you nothing out of pocket. Go ahead and check out the debt elimination scams if you'd like to. You wouldn't take money from a loan shark, so you may not want to give your money to a debt shark. For an understanding of what a financial genius you truly are, call 800-409-5633. On the web, mydebtfreepath.com. 800-409-5633.
Welcome back to the Peter Mac Show. We're glad you're tuning in this afternoon, this Sunday, June 10th. This is the show I started 5.5 years ago, and I've been glad to be on the Republic Broadcasting Network here for about 2 months now, April and May, and done a few shows here in June. And let me just tell you, if you want to get a hold of the written material that Larry Beecraft, my guest today, has prepared, he has a wealth of information that you can find. And if you simply go to a search engine and type in Beecraft's Briefs, it'll bring up his webpage, and one of the articles there is federal jurisdiction, and we're going to discuss that, recap some of what we talked about last week. Also, if you want to email me at any time, just do so by sending me an email to peter@petermacshow.com. Okay, Larry, let's get back to federal jurisdiction then, if we could.
Well, let's kind of recap some of the matters we covered last week, how this became an interest in the movement. In the early 80s, after I'd been associated with this movement for a couple of years, I detected that a lot of people didn't really have a good concept of what jurisdiction is. For example, you have jurisdiction that's judicial jurisdiction. And judicial jurisdiction is set forth in statutes. You know, like, for example, if you pull out Title 28, which is the judicial code and the United States code, you can read all these various sections, 1331, 1332, 1333, you know, that sequence, that'll sit there and tell you what type of jurisdiction they have. You know, jurisdiction is conferred on a specific court by statute. Now, there's been in the movement a lot of people that have come along, well, jurisdiction is conferred by the Friends of the Flag. You know, those types of arguments have no substance. They're popular. You know, a lot of people get out and start, well, they dig into the topic and they become convinced of it, and in their enthusiasm, they go out and start promoting it. But, you know, things like, you know, it's conferred by the French flag or any flag, or that we're vessels of the United States and things of that nature. You know, that simply has no relationship to judicial jurisdiction. But nonetheless, back in the early 80s, there were people that were confused about, you know, jurisdiction, judicial jurisdiction, governmental jurisdiction. So, you know, I attempted an effort to educate the movement about jurisdiction. And what I did was, I produced a brief. What you see on my website is what I wrote back in the mid-80s. You know, it's just if you go to my website and click on this little brief, the first major topic of discussion on my website, after you get through all this introductory stuff, is the topic of jurisdiction. And the very first link there, under the very first topic, is federal jurisdiction brief. And I'm going to be talking about that this afternoon. But jurisdiction is important. You know, we've got 50 states in this union, and each of them, in and of themselves, they're jurisdictions. You know, there's Alabama's got a jurisdiction, Missouri's got a jurisdiction, New York's got a jurisdiction, Texas, California, each state is a separate jurisdiction. But even within the states, you have county governments or parish governments, and each governmental unit has a jurisdiction that is geographical. Well, when it comes to the distinction between federal jurisdiction and state jurisdiction, you know, the most important constitutional provision that relates to that is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the United States Constitution. That reads, you know, Congress shall have the power of exclusive legislation over Washington, D.C., or, you know, the 10 square miles,
right,
and forest magazines, arsenal, dockyards, and other needful buildings. And the reason, there was a very specific reason that provision was included in the Constitution. As I talked about last week, there were some soldiers from the Revolutionary War that had not been paid that went to Philadelphia. And Congress was meeting in Philadelphia at that time, and of course, you know, it had no jurisdiction, and it was sitting within the jurisdiction of a state. And you could see in a situation like that, you know, how a federal government, a federal Congress, sitting within the jurisdiction of a state, could come under the influence of a state jurisdiction.
Sure.
If a state government was in favor of or against the people that were protesting against the Congress, it could exert its influence on the Congress itself. So, you know, after Congress in that particular situation fled ultimately to Annapolis, Maryland, you know, a lesson was learned. We needed to give to the federal government jurisdiction that it did not have even at that time.
Right.
So that's the reason why we included in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the U.S. Constitution. Well, once it got there, you know, the most that people really knew about this topic was what they read in the Federalist Papers. And the Federalist Papers kind of explained the reasons for and why we had a division of jurisdiction in the United States Constitution. But really, the full parameters of what a federal jurisdiction means really can only come out through the cases themselves that you read on this point. Now, if you go over to my website and read this brief, I've got links to the important cases. And it's something I consider to be real important. You know, I encounter people all the time. You know, I know it's difficult for people to sit out and study law, but it is real important. We've got an abusive government out there. There's a lot of people that are concerned about the activities of government, but, you know, you can't travel upon, you can't make arguments based upon, you know, just something that you hear based on rumor and hearsay.
Right.
And there's just too much of that in the whole freedom movement. And, you know, I would suggest cases are not all that difficult to learn. You know, if you've never sat down and read some cases, you know, just dive in. Sit down and read it. And you'll realize after a while there isn't anything like, you know, just actually doing it. Sitting down and reading the cases, and you'll find that, you know, it's different from reading a newspaper. It's different from reading a book. You know, it's legalese. But after a while, you'll become intrigued by it. You know, I became so intrigued by it when I was in law school. You know, that's what I've done all my adult life is read cases.
Sure.
But, you know, cases are not all that difficult to understand, and they're very important for helping you, to educate people about principles of law. Now, the first case we want to talk about in reference to jurisdiction, you know, one of the very first, there were a couple of other lesser cases that were decided before this time, but a very important case was decided by the Supreme Court in 1818. It's called United States against Bevins. And the interesting question that arose in that case, you had a sailor commit murder on a warship laying in the harbor of Boston. And the question came up, well, do the feds have jurisdiction over this crime, or does the state?
Right.
And that issue went to the United States Supreme Court, and here you have, on a warship of the United States, a murder committed.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court, you know, outlined this history about federal jurisdiction based on Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. And the ultimate conclusion that was reached was, hey, you know, the state of Massachusetts has jurisdiction over this crime because it occurred in Boston Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in essence, what the Bevins case does is it, in essence, clearly points out that there's a difference and a distinction between state jurisdiction and federal jurisdiction. In this particular situation involving Bevins, you know, they held that the state of Massachusetts had jurisdiction over the crime. Let's flip forward a couple of years, about 50 years, until we get to 1885, and there's another. This is perhaps one of the most important cases on jurisdiction that was decided in the 1800s. It's called Fort Leavenworth Railway Company against Lowe. And here you had a railroad that was passing through Fort Leavenworth, which at that time was, a military base. But in any event, you had a railroad going through there.
Right.
And, you know, of course, the state of, you know, of course, leading up to Fort Leavenworth, you're in Kansas.
Right.
And when you leave Fort Leavenworth, you enter again into Kansas.
Right.
So the question becomes, you know, well, you know, the state of Kansas had imposed a tax on the right-of-way of the railroad company, and, of course, there was no dispute about the track that laid in obviously in Kansas, but the question became, what about the taxes for the railroad track that goes through Fort Leavenworth? Mm-hmm. Now, in this particular case, you know, the Supreme Court kind of set out, you know, what it takes to acquire jurisdiction pursuant to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. The court noted, you know, that the states were, you know, the sovereign states. They had the power to tax.
Right.
And the way that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 operated is this, you know, that in order for Congress to have jurisdiction inside of a state, it's got to go out and buy the land, and once it's bought, then they have to go to Congress or, you know, interested parties, but, you know, somebody's got to approach the state legislature and say, hey, cede jurisdiction of this property to Uncle Sam.
Right.
And without that session, without the actual state legislature coming up with an act that says, you know, the United States shall have jurisdiction over this spot on the face of the earth, mm-hmm. you know, under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, Uncle Sam doesn't have jurisdiction.
Right.
And that's very important. I think last week we were talked about this one case, I think it's in Montana, but this was a murder case also. And it's kind of odd. Peter, I don't know if you know anything about how land is divided up, but there's a thing known as a baseline and a central line, and legal descriptions for land is categorized by sections.
Okay.
And a section is 1 square mile. You know, each the north side's 1 mile, and south side's 1 mile, and east and west 1 mile.
Okay.
And there's generally 640 acres included within a section. Now, you know, that's presuming that, you know, you got straight lines.
Right.
You know, I can show you here. I've done real property work here in North Alabama, and I can show you spots, you know, where, you know, you got the section line that goes up to the Tennessee River, and then across the river, you know, the surveyors picked up, and, you know, they're at least a couple hundred feet north of where the section line should be. So if you look at a topo map or a section map of state of Alabama, you know, not all the lines mesh up because we got some mountains. But then if you go to some place like Kansas or Illinois or places like that, you know, you can fly over property and you can see all these roads that are built along section lines.
Right.
But in any event, you know, you know, surveyors have property. You know, we all know that George Washington was a surveyor in his youth. He went to, well, it looks like we got a break coming up. Let's pick up with George after we come back.
Okay. Hang with us, folks. We'll be right back with Larry Beecraft in a couple minutes.
Have you heard of a privacy crisis? Odds are you're already immersed in one. The U.S. government is now legally tapping phones, monitoring emails, tracking purchases, and seizing property in record numbers. Banks are demanding invasive personal information for even the smallest transaction. Unfortunately, stalkers looking to harm you or your financial situation are using the same methods. So how can you protect yourself, your loved ones, and all that you own? Well, the first step is to purchase the most important how-to book you'll ever read. It's called Privacy Crisis by author Grant Hall. In minutes, you'll know the methods he himself has used and advised others about in order to bank anonymously, open a safety deposit box without a social security number. With Privacy Crisis, you'll discover how to avoid judgments, seal your credit files airtight, drop off the radar, and virtually disappear from those looking to cause you injury. The ebook and hardcover versions are available at www.privacycrisis.com. Grant Hall's Privacy Crisis contains information and legal methods the powers that be don't want you to know. Travel, bank, work, and live anonymously, live free. You can also order Privacy Crisis by telephone. Call 702-433-6222.
All right, employees, listen up. Our group health insurance premium just went up again. In fact, it's doubled in the last 4 years, and now we've been forced to try something new. So we're increasing the annual deductible from $500 to $2,500. Okay, cut the moaning. The good news is you'll all still only have to pay your regular $500 deductible. The company is installing a new health reimbursement arrangement, or HRA plan, that will pay up to $2,000 in benefits only to those employees who have deductible expenses. This new HRA plan is saving us a lot of money.
Employers all over the country are discovering how to roll back insurance costs using Core Documents' HRA concept. Core Documents is the nation's primary source for affordable plan documents required by the IRS and Department of Labor for Section 125 and HRA plans. Use your insurance agent and let Core Documents help you with plan design. Do a Google search for Core Documents or see us at coredocuments.com. That's Core, C-O-R-E, documents, plural, .com.
I found this company online, and they had this really unique variety of salt wellness products. I read some of the articles and ended up ordering this beautiful salt lamp. According to the company, they said that the salt crystal lamps gently purify indoor air. I was so amazed. I put it in the baby's room, and it made a perfect nightlight. Both my husband and I could tell the difference.
SoleWellness.com is a unique company that offers salt wellness products from around the world.
So, I went back to the site and ordered their Soleil Simple Natural Cleaning Products, also made with Himalayan salt. I figured it would clean really well. The natural cleaning products worked wonderfully, and there was no scent. This company has so many products my whole family can enjoy and feel better with. Plus, the service was great.
If you're interested in natural, homeopathic, time-tested remedies, visit SoleilWellness.com. That's S-O-L-A-Y Wellness.com or call 312-224-2710, 312-224-2710.
Thanks for tuning in here to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Special guest with me today is Larry Beecraft, and we're discussing federal jurisdiction. Larry, is it fair to say then, and tell me if this is an oversimplification, that basically the states have jurisdiction over everything within their territory, within the geographical bounds of the state, and the federal government has jurisdiction within the 10 square miles we call Washington, D.C., and only those areas that happen to be within the territorial boundaries of states that the states have ceded to the federal government?
Well, Peter, what you said in reference to the jurisdiction of the states, I'm not saying that. The Supreme Court of the United States says that, and a number of state Supreme Courts say that, and a number of appellate courts say that. Now, in reference to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, you know, your last statement, you said, you know, it only has jurisdiction in Washington, D.C., the federal enclaves in the states, the territories and insular possessions. It can have jurisdiction outside those areas in other ways, and I think that that's something that we'll cover here in a moment if we can lay the groundwork first for, you know, to deal with the question of jurisdiction. Right before the break, we were talking about George Washington going out and surveying the lands. Well, sometime after he did that, Lewis and Clark went on their expedition up through the Northwest.
Right.
And after they came along, you had the settlement of the West. And let's take a situation involving Montana. You know, Montana, back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, was still territory. Mm-hmm. And it was sparsely populated. Well, there was a fort that was located in Montana. And it had, I'm just going to use a guess here because I don't have a legal description of mine, but let's say that, you know, this fort was in Section 15. It was the southwest quarter of Section 15 Township, 2 North, Section Range 3 West. You know, that's just pulling something out of the wild blue yonder.
Right.
But a quarter of a section is 160 acres. Well, the fort happened to be built on the section line. Somebody made a mistake. And so you had the section line, or the line for the property that was within the jurisdiction of the United States, went right through the middle of the fort.
Okay.
Well, there was a murder that was committed, and a fellow by the name of Tully was ultimately charged with it. Well, first the feds came along and said, well, you know, the murder was committed within our jurisdiction. And he defended himself by saying, no, it happened outside your jurisdiction.
Now, the murder happened in the fort?
Yeah, it happened in the fort.
Okay.
But in that remarkable situation, whoever put the fort out there didn't put it on the property. You know, we've had those problems in the past a lot of times. But the whole fort, you know, half of the fort, let's say, you know, I don't know how much, but, you know, some part of it was within federal jurisdiction and some part wasn't.
Okay.
And, you know, the murder was committed inside the fort. Well, mm-hmm. You know, when the feds prosecuted Tully, you know, his defense was, well, you know, it didn't take place within U.S. jurisdiction. You know, that part, you know, there must have been a line or something like that. You know, that you had surveyors that could say, oh, here's the line. You know, then in the courtroom, what you'll see is a chart, you know, a big mm-hmm. piece of paper or poster board or something like that, you know, and, well, the murder's committed over here, and here's the line, you know.
Right.
Somebody's got a little dotted line. Well, that was his defense in the federal case. Well, the jury bought it and acquit. The case was dismissed because it didn't happen in the jurisdiction of the United States. Well, then the state turns around and Tully defends and said, no, it happened in the federal jurisdiction.
Okay.
So, you know, Tully's just a case that involves, you know, a real oddity. Mm-hmm. And those are the types of things that can crop up. But, you know, if you really want to learn something about jurisdiction, you know, I would suggest that people go over to my website, you know, just do Beecraft Briefs on Google's and then come over to my website and then come to this first topic called jurisdiction and read the brief itself. And then I would strongly encourage people to sit down and, you know, actually read the cases that are linked there. Now, let me kind of capsulize, or, you know, summarize this with some cases that were decided in 1943. And this is a real good illustration of the way that jurisdiction operates. There was two cases that went to the Supreme Court, one is Pacific Coast Dairy against Department of Agriculture of California, and another one is Penn Dairies against the Milk Control Commission of Pennsylvania. Now, Peter, I don't know, have you ever been out to the Bay Area?
And, San Francisco?
Yeah, San Francisco, right.
Yes,
and,
right.
You know, down there at San Jose, you know, right at the bottom of the bay, you see these big concrete structures. And, you know, you can imagine, you know, they used to hold inside these blimps.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's there at Moffett Field. And that's what I'm talking about. This particular case has an actual controversy for Moffett Field, which is there, you know, on the north side of San Jose, on the south side of the bay. And it's that place, as you're driving along the interstate, you can look off there and see these big, huge concrete structures that held blimps inside. That's Moffett Field.
Okay.
Well, Pacific Coast Dairy entered into a contract to deliver milk to Moffett Field. And the contract was consummated on the base itself. Well, the Pacific Coast was charging the Army, or I guess it was the Army. It might have been the Air Force at that time. But it was charging the military base, you know, less than the state minimum price for milk.
Okay.
So the Department of Agriculture of California proceeded against Pacific Coast Dairy and said, oh, you know, you were subject to the minimum price for milk. And that controversy went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, no, look, you know, this contract was consummated on Moffett Field. And the
military base. Yeah, okay. Hang on, folks. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Hi, Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. The J. Michael Stevens Group is shipping a lot of storable food. It's smart that you're getting going at your food supplies. 1 week after the report came out that the world had eaten more food than it produced last year, the country turned into a deep freeze, wiping out a huge part of the new crop. An example? In 24 hours, clementine oranges doubled in price. If you intend to start or finish your supply, call immediately. When you call, tell them how many adults and how many years of food you need. When there are shortages, missing items will be substituted, maintaining the quantity of food necessary. Money is not the problem. Availability is. Be careful. When food supplies get short, with no future, many retailers ship real trash to supply you. For safe food you can trust, call 800-409-5633. On the web, efoodsdirect.com. 800-409-5633.
In the United States, it is now estimated that over 90% of family income is now being used to pay back consumer debt. Because of financial problems, mostly from credit card debt, approximately 1 in 4 families struggle to pay bills on even basic necessities such as mortgage, food, and utilities. And with millions of people desperately searching for a fresh start, North American Educational Services is here to help you regain your financial independence. We are very proud that the Debt Relief Educational Services Program has helped over 8,100 families nationwide since 1998, eliminating over $215 million of credit card debt, and still counting, and enabled clients to stop monthly payments immediately. The NAES program is unique, designed to help you, the consumer, not your creditors. To take back your financial freedom, call 1-888-245-7097. That's 1-888-245-7097. Or visit www.integritydebtoptions.com.
Are you paying exorbitant amounts of interest to your mortgage lender? We as Americans have been led down a path of paying excessive amounts of interest to the lending institutions. Stop paying tens of thousands of dollars in mortgage interest and start saving. Our financial experts have spent 2 years and about $2 million on a revolutionary interest reduction solution that will show you how to pay off 100% of your mortgage and other debt in as little as 8 to 11 years with no change to your current lifestyle or spending habits. No increase to your monthly mortgage payments, no refinancing, and no out-of-pocket expense. That's right. Take 19 to 22 years off your 30-year mortgage. This is not a bi-weekly payment program or a debt roll-down program. It's much more. Sound too good to be true? Find out just how good. Visit interestreductionsolutions.com or call 1-800-281-5094. That's 1-800-281-5094. Ask about our free DVD and financial analysis report.
Okay, welcome back to the Peter Mac Show. Thanks for tuning in here. We're discussing federal jurisdiction through a number of cases with Larry Beecraft. If you want to follow along, you can go to his website, which you can access quickly through Beecraft's Briefs. Just put that in your search engine. Again, Beecraft, that's B-E-C-R-A-F-T, apostrophe S, Beecraft's Briefs. And that'll take you there. And one of the links midway down or so is federal jurisdiction brief, and you can sort of follow along there if you want to or access it later. You can email me at any time at peter@petermacshow. Okay, Larry, so you're discussing this case.
There were two cases decided in 43, and of course there's a lot of others, you know, the topic. There's, you know, I spent back in about 85 in my effort to, you know, put together a brief on this. You know, it became an intriguing research project for myself as well. You know, I learned more about jurisdiction. I learned in law school. You know, you just learned the basics there.
Right.
But when you sit down and you start, you're doing something like a brief, and you said, "Wow, I'm gonna catalog all the cases I possibly can." You know, if you go over my website, you know, I've got about 500 cases. You know, I must have read 1,500, and
wow.
I've cataloged about 500. You know, there's, I don't know how many Supreme Court cases there are, but all the Supreme Court cases on jurisdiction are linked. And then I've got a list of the state cases and all the circuit court cases. And you can pull up these different files and just read a short blurb about each case. And then, you know, if you find a case that's interesting, you know, go to the law library, get it, copy it, read it.
Right.
But
I want to I'm sorry, I wanted to clarify for the listeners that the case we're talking about, Moffett Field, Moffett Field is a military installation. And then the concern here is about whether California has jurisdiction right. over forcing this milk company to adhere to the state-mandated minimum price of milk.
That's correct. And that issue went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, since the contract was consummated on a military enclave, you know, the state law regarding the regulating the price of milk did not apply there. Mm-hmm. And so the Supreme Court said, hey, you know, the minimum price of California for milk doesn't apply within Moffett Field. Well, now let's take another case decided in the same year, the Pendaires case. Well, there you had a military facility, but it was a military camp that was on leased land.
Uh-huh.
And the Supreme Court said, well, you know, this is a deciding difference here. And because the facility, the military camp, was on leased land, the Supreme Court said, well, you know, Pennsylvania's minimum price for milk applies on mm-hmm. the leased property. So what you have, you know, you've got a general proposition. Well, you've got a general provision in the United States Constitution dealing with jurisdiction. And you have a number of cases on the point that just kind of really elucidate what jurisdiction is. Let me kind of conclude with this case. This is what I used to when I was educating people, got on the speaker circuit about jurisdiction.
Let me pose this question real quick, Larry, just for clarification. Moffett Field then had already been ceded by California to the federal government, so there was no question about whose jurisdiction applied over Moffett Field when that case came up.
Right.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
It was also pre-1940. I might throw this in at the same time. You had a law that existed in up to 1940 that said, you know, no building. You know, Uncle Sam could go out and buy land, but he couldn't improve the land unless jurisdiction of the state had been ceded to the federal government by the state legislature. And so if you take a look, you know, just physically today, you know, if you go around and take a look at facilities that were, you know, developed prior to 1940, you know that Uncle Sam's got jurisdiction there. But one of the things that follows with jurisdiction is, you know, police enforcement. And if Uncle Sam is sitting, you know, what do you do about a post office sitting in downtown Chicago or downtown St. Louis? You know, does Uncle Sam really want jurisdiction there? You know, if something happens there, you know, then you have to have a case prosecuted in federal court. And, you know, does Uncle Sam necessarily want that? So in 1940, you know, that requirement that before any building could be built on federal property, Uncle Sam must have jurisdiction, you know, that was repealed. And now, today, I think it's probably General Services Administration, you know, Uncle Sam will, you know, talk to state officials and determine what jurisdiction that Uncle Sam really wants, and we'll get the legislature to cede that type of jurisdiction to it. Let me give you an example about how jurisdiction is real important. Pardon me for that. In the 1960s, you know, if you go to downtown Chicago, 219 South Dearborn is basically a half a block, and on that is this big, tall federal building. And across the street at 230 South Dearborn is another federal building. But before the federal building that sits there now at 219 South Dearborn was built in the 70s. Before that time, there was a federal courthouse there, but it only took up half the block. Well, for that courthouse, Uncle Sam had jurisdiction. So when they tore down that old courthouse and built the new one, what you have is that you got half the building is in federal jurisdiction and half isn't.
Wow.
Because they took up more land when they expanded. They tore down the courthouse that took up half a block. Now they take up a whole block.
Uh-huh.
And so you got a real oddity of jurisdiction there. But, you know, Uncle Sam has a real problem if it's only got a small facility. You know, like if you're out in, let's say, Mentone, Alabama with a post office there and you buy a quarter of an acre of land and put a little post office into a place that services a community of 500 people, does Uncle Sam want jurisdiction there? No.
Right.
And so, you know, now jurisdiction is a lot more sophisticated, and it's dependent upon arrangements made between Uncle Sam and the states. And that's just the way things have developed over time. But, you know, in order for Uncle Sam to have exclusive jurisdiction over a piece of property within the states, he's got to have ownership of the land, and he's got to have a cession or jurisdiction from the state to the United States.
In other words, the state has to agree to it. They just can't go in there and purchase that land from whoever.
The state has to cede jurisdiction. That's correct.
Okay.
Now, let me give you – here's one final illustration. It's a case called United States against Townsend. And this I think, is kind of – it's got some kind of funny facts. You know, it's kind of modern. And it's illustrative of these principles. You know, there was a I forgot the state where this happened. It may have been Mississippi or Louisiana, but it's a Fifth Circuit case. Anyway, there's a military facility there, and, you know, these officers' clubs will hire bands to come in and play, you know, like on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on one evening, let's call it a Friday night, the band that was playing was called Cleo's Funky Express. And so they played there, let's say, on Friday night, and they didn't have the gig for the next night. Some other band did. And so that band came in and set up their equipment. And somehow, some way, as one band is playing and leaves and another band comes on, some equipment ends up missing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it soon is concluded, well, you know, the band that played here the night before, Cleo's Funkies Express, took some equipment that belonged to the band that came in the following night. So they started looking for the members of Cleo's Funkies Express, and they found them down the road playing at some other gig, you know, probably some Joe's Cowboy Bar. And they arrested the guy and charged him in federal court. And that case went up on appeal, and the Court of Appeals said, you know, he was charged with receiving stolen property. And there was absolutely no proof in the case that Townsend, a member of Cleo's Funkies Express, maybe he was the guitarist or something like that, but there was no proof in the record that Townsend, while he had been found in possession of, let's say, you know, missing guitar or whatever it was, while he had been found in possession of recently stolen property, there was no proof that he had he was the one that took it from the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States, so the case was dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these are how, you know, this is a land boundary jurisdiction problem. You know, just as surely as there's a boundary between North Alabama and Southern Tennessee, and just as surely as there's a boundary between on a river between Missouri and Illinois, and just as sure as there's a boundary between North and South Dakota, mm-hmm. you know, those boundaries define the different jurisdictions of the states. And equally, the jurisdiction of the United States has boundaries. And inside the states, those boundaries are, number one, a legal description of whatever means. You know, like here in Huntsville, Alabama, we've got a Redstone Arsenal out here, which is a very large facility, and NASA got its start there. Mm-hmm. But, you can physically see the boundaries. Typically, there's a fence around it.
Right.
But, you know, you can absolutely locate federal property on the face of the earth, and then you check and see if there's a statute of some type from the state legislature to see if that property's been, jurisdiction for that property's been ceded to the United States. Now, I want to mention one final thing, and then I think we ought to probably move on to some tax questions.
Right, and we do have a caller, so we'll take our caller as soon as you mentioned this one thing about jurisdiction.
Now, this jurisdiction, you know, when I was doing this study on jurisdiction, you know, greatly expanding, you know, my knowledge of the cases on the point, you know, rather than just general principles that I learned in law school. But, you know, digging into the details of the cases, one evening I was just reading a Fifth Circuit case, I think it was, and I ran across the site to this 1957 government report. And so the next morning I got to my office and I called this lady, Billy Murdoch, that I was working with in Salt Lake City, Utah, and said, Billy, hey, this looks like an interesting government report. Go see if you can find it. Well, she called me back the next day. She had found it. And as it turns out, that's a very important government report on jurisdiction. And I encourage everyone to read this government report on jurisdiction. And the way that they can obtain that, let me just tell you, Larkin Rose. Now, you may know something about this website. You know, all I know is it 861.info or 861-info?
I'm not sure anymore.
Okay, me either. I just called him right before we got on, and I wrote it down, and I now don't know whether it's a dot or a dash, and I don't know whether there's www in front of it.
I'll try to find it real quick.
Okay, but, you know, it's 861-info or 861.info. But Larkin is going to – I sent to him a CD. Now, the CD has a lot of information on it, including a PDF image of this 1957 government report. So if you would like to read the actual government report, you can either get it from Larkin, or you can go over to Constitution.org, John Rowland's website, and you can look around. He's got a whole lot posted there. But the whole PDF of the jurisdiction report's also posted there. Big download, but... You know, people can get the jurisdiction report, and I strongly encourage everyone to read it.
All right. Very good. Okay, and we're going to tie this to the federal income tax, but let's go ahead and take this call. We have George from Florida waiting patiently. So, George, thank you for waiting. You're on the Peter Mac Show. All right. Well, sorry, George.
Well, how about Steve from West Virginia?
Okay. I wasn't aware that there was a Steve. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just looking at the caller site.
Okay. Larry, apparently you need to refresh your page.
Okay, I did, and the callers are still here.
Well, I don't know if that's an old one because they're telling me they're not there. Okay. Well, we presently don't have any callers at this point. So,
well, let's move on to income tax. How about that?
Absolutely. And connect it with federal jurisdiction if we can.
I would like to tell people that the CD that you can get from Larkin. There's the old tax regulations, the new tax regulations, and a lot of the tax acts are on that CD. And the old tax regulations were scanned into PDF, and then OmniPage was run, and the conversion, the text conversion of the PDF images was saved underneath the PDF images themselves, which is what I like to do if I'm converting, you know, something like an official document.
Sure.
But you save the text, the converted text, underneath the PDF image, then you can do word searches. You know, I've done that for the entire United States statutes at large. But, you know, the federal income tax, when the first one under the 16th Amendment was adopted in 1916, the Commissioner of Internal Revenue published Regulations 33. And then when Congress adopted the 1916 Act, we had Regulations 33 revised. And then by 1918, we had the Revenue Act of, or by 1919, we had the Revenue Act of 1918, and we had Regulations 45 that came out for that. And every time Congress would come out, you know, roughly every 2 years with a new tax act, there would be a new set of income tax regulations that went along with that particular act.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have in reference to the income tax is this, as we covered last week. The current code, you know, the point that we made last week was this. You know, the Supreme Court of the United States says you can't look at the tax laws in isolation. Okay. And the reason for that is there's a rule in effect called, the construction by pari materiae.
Okay.
And pari materiae means you got to construe the whole thing all together. Well, you know, that's particularly important for the income tax because the 1986 Act is nothing more than the renamed 1954 Internal Revenue Code. You know, the 54 code came into effect in August of 54, and it was in effect from 54 through 86. And then in 86, all Congress did is say, well, let's change the name of it to the 86 code.
Right.
Well, the 86 code is the 54 code, but the 54 code is nothing more than the 39 code as it existed, you know, during the summer of 1954. And imagine somebody sitting down and taking the 39 code and just cutting up the section numbers and subsections and, you know, shuffling them like a deck of cards, then, you know, reorganizing them. And then changing some of the wordings, wording to, you know, make it a little, More complex? Is that what you would want to call it, Peter?
That's a charitable.
More deceptive. How about that?
Yeah, okay.
But in any event, you know, what you have is the 39 code was reshuffled into the 54 code, but the 39 code, as we talked about last week, is nothing more than the codification of the 1938 Act. Well, the 1938 Act was in lieu of the 1936 tax, and the 36 tax was in lieu of the 34 tax, and the 34 tax was in lieu of the 32 tax, and the 32 tax was in lieu of the 28 tax, and the 28 tax was in lieu of the 26 tax. The 26 tax was in lieu of the 24, and 24 was in lieu of the 21, and 21 was in lieu of the 1918, and 1918 was in lieu of the 1916 and 1917 acts. So, you know, you have, all of this stuff ties together. You know, if you sit down and you take a look at, well, I want to study tax imposed, section mm-hmm. 1 of the code.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you do that, you'll develop this whole in lieu of that I've just talked about.
Okay.
Come on, folks.
Yeah, we'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with Larry Beecraft in just a couple minutes. Stay with us.
Catholic priest calls on Catholics and Christians to resist an unjust attack against Iran. Father John Martinez, a Catholic priest, speaks out to declare the Catholic Church's true teaching, that it would be a mortal sin for Catholic soldiers to attack Iran. In a one-hour lecture, Father John Martinez warns about the Jewish plot to rule the world and to use the United States to ignite the flames of World War III by its satanic plan to unjustly attack Iran. He exposes that George Bush is Jewish and how Congress is controlled by the Jews. Father John Martinez gravely warns of nuclear weapons being used by the United States and the threat of the possible end of the world. For additional information on how you can help stop World War III, order Father John Martinez's CD entitled An Unjust Attack on Iran, available for $10 by Father John Martinez. Just go to www.republicbroadcasting.org and click on our web banner for the address.
Businesses and their employees are facing constant increases in group medical insurance premiums. Employees are shouldering more of the burden themselves. Core Documents, the nation's primary source for affordable medical plan documents, has the answer. A health reimbursement arrangement, or HRA. Business owners, managers, find out now how your company can utilize a much higher deductible health insurance policy and establish an HRA to fund low deductibles for your employees. And employees, tell the boss to visit coredocuments.com now. This new HRA plan can save you thousands of dollars.
Employers all over the country are discovering how to roll back insurance costs using Core Documents' HRA concept. Core Documents is the nation's primary source for affordable plan documents required by the IRS and Department of Labor for Section 125 and HRA plans. Use your insurance agent and let Core Documents help you with plan design. Do a Google search for Core Documents or see us at coredocuments.com. That's Core, C-O-R-E, documents, plural, .com.
I found this company online, and they had this really unique variety of salt wellness products. I read some of the articles and ended up ordering this beautiful salt lamp. According to the company, they said that the salt crystal lamps gently purify indoor air. I was so amazed. I put it in the baby's room, and it made a perfect nightlight. Both my husband and I could tell the difference.
SoleWellness.com is a unique company that offers salt wellness products from around the world.
So, I went back to the site and ordered their Soleil Simple Natural Cleaning Products, also made with Himalayan salt. I figured it would clean really well. The natural cleaning products worked wonderfully, and there was no scent. This company has so many products my whole family can enjoy and feel better with. Plus, the service was great.
If you're interested in natural, homeopathic, time-tested remedies, visit SoleilWellness.com. That's S-O-L-A-Y Wellness.com. Or call 312-224-2710. 312-224-2710.
Okay, welcome back to the Peter Mac Show. It's about 6 minutes before the top of the hour. We're discussing the federal income tax. Just started with Larry Beecraft. Okay, Larry, so you have all these tax acts passed in lieu of the preceding one. up to 1939, and then the 39 code really is the same as the 54 with some renumbering and change of sections and so forth, and then that's the same as the 86 code, which we're currently operating under, right?
That's correct. And going moving forward into time, you know, you have the 1916 and 1917. The 1916 Act imposed a tax. 1917 just kind of increased the rates. But then in 1918, they said, well, in lieu of the tax imposed in 1916 and 1917, there is hereby imposed the following tax. And that's what happened, you know, from that time forward. You know, that by 1926, the 26 Act says, in lieu of the tax imposed in the 24, and if you go back to the 24, it says, in lieu of the tax imposed in the 21, and when you go back to the 21, it says, in lieu of the one in 1918, and you go back to the one in 1918, it says, well, in lieu of the 1916 and 1917 tax, there is hereby this tax imposed. Well, but by the time you get up to 1928, that changes. You know, if you were to pull out the 1928 Act and look at it, you just say, well, there is hereby imposed this tax. And it doesn't say anything about in lieu of. Well, you know, what they did is they carved up, you know, the in lieu of feature and stuck it over in Section 63 of the 1928 Act. And, of course, the 1928 Act is the format for what was ultimately became the 39 Code, you know, the same structure. Mm-hmm. You know, Section 1 and 4 through 4, introductory provisions, Section 11 imposed the tax, and then you had special classes of taxpayer. You know, that pattern emerged by 1928. But the 1928 Section 63 made it clear that, you know, it said this tax is imposed in lieu of the one in 1926.
I'm sorry, let me just, in lieu of means it replaces the previous tax act, right?
That's correct, right.
Okay.
And so by the time you're up at the 38, you know, Section 63 is still there. You know, it says the tax imposed in this act is in lieu of the previous one. Well, the Section 63 didn't go into the 39 code. You know, that's one of the things that was left out. So Section 63 of the 1938 Act still exists today. And so that ties it all together, and that's the reason why I'm saying that it's so important for people to at least have a good understanding of this in lieu of feature, mm-hmm. and then they also need to have a good understanding of, you know, how this all developed. And it's real important, you know, if you go back, you know, Peter, it seems like to me it's a lot easier to comprehend something. This is basically the same thing, but in fewer pages. And that's what the old tax acts are like. You know, there are fewer pages. It's a lot easier to study them than, you know, something like the big, long, current 1986 tax code that we've got.
Right, but if you go back, but 28 is the last time they said in lieu of, right? And then from that point forward, it was just...
Well, the 38, in 38.
38, okay. Yeah. So that should be as far back as we need to go then, right? Because if 38's in lieu of what preceded it, then what's in effect in 38 is what's in effect now, unless something has replaced it in lieu of, right?
Right, right. But okay. I mean, but it all ties together. You know, the same right. scheme that starts in 1916.
Right.
You know, and as you move forward, by the time you get into 21 and 24, you know, you begin to see a pattern in the tax acts. And to me, it becomes real clear by the time you get up to the 28 Act and the 39 Code.
Okay, stay with us. Let's see what you mean by real clear when we get back, folks. Stay with us. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
A message from